Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Suzanne L. Morsi, co-founder and CEO of BrightEye. Suzanne, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So why don't we kick things off? Would love to learn about BrightEye and the problems you're solving in the market.
Sure. So our mission at BrightEye is to help any organization. We say enterprise, and sometimes people think enterprise is really large, but it's really medium to large organizations and companies really unlock the data assets that they have. Our mission is, as we step back and look at all the things that are an opportunity, we see the greatest opportunity in transforming the way work happens. We are passionate about having data-informed work. What we mean by that is that as you step back and think about your role, whether you're an individual contributor, middle manager, or executive, you should very much start your work from a data-informed position or starting point at the start of your day, the start of your week, or whenever that is. And what we mean by that is the decisions we make, the strategies that we set, the collaboration amongst teams needs to start from a place where there's confidence and evidence in data. Now, the irony of this is there is really no singular entity from mom and pop shops all the way to the enterprises of the world that doesn't have data. The data assets are abundant. The data assets continue to grow exponentially. Every single second on planet Earth, there is data being created simply because we are technology we're a technology adopting species. So there's more data, in fact, much more data than the human being has been able to process. Not the human brain, but just the way that we work. And so when we step back at BrightEye, our goal, our mission, our passion is all around, wouldn't it be great if everyone is able to start from a data-informed point of view? Just if you have a question, if you're curious about something, you can say, let me see what the data says, and actually be able to do that yourself as a self-sufficient member of a team. Teams are multifunctional. You've got people in strategy, people in marketing and finance, customer success, and teams that are data engineering teams. And this, this reality is those that are, trained in data engineering, data science, data analysis are the ones that are most equipped to unlock that data. But even then, there is just a lot of data tools. So the story of BrightEye really stems from the idea that the future of work is that anyone in the enterprise, anyone across any team, regardless of where they sit, can turn on to the data assets that they have, the spreadsheets, the PDFs, the videos, right, where there's all of these different types of market research. There's a shopping cart and credit card transactions after the holidays. I mean, there's just all kinds of data, right, and be able to really crack and accelerate the time to insight so that when you are recommending something to your middle management, when you are taking a decision, when you're optimizing a workflow, when you are changing a policy, you're able to show with confidence that you are able to unlock insight from that data. And so the platform itself that we'll talk about today is, we're very excited about it because in this AI era, how we solve for this problem where we're making anybody be a data analyst in the enterprise, where our goal is to give a fully functioning turnkey data team to any team in the enterprise. And again, let me just also caution and make sure everybody understands what we're talking about here is that this is happening in your cloud. The goal in the end of this journey is that when we step back and look at collectively as a company or as a set of teams, that we were able to change the way that we inform each other from the data assets that sit in a very fragmented nature across the different organization. So that's our mission. The platform is agentic, as I was just trying to mention. In an era of AI, what we've done is take the promise of agentic AI, and it's not even a promise, it's 100% happening, right? And created specialized agents that mimic a full data engineering and data analysis team. And just think about that, right? We took seven agents that we've designed, engineered, and assigned them very specific tasks and monitor their performance on those tasks, and then created an agentic orchestration layer that orchestrates the seven of them working in unison, just would like a data team would work. And that is the end-to-end platform promise.
Fantastic. For the benefit of our audience, because I suspect there may be some of them who are not yet familiar with AI agents, can you just give a brief overview, please?
Great. So agents are, you know, you hear about this. This is the year of the agents. This is the year of agentic AI. So AI is artificial intelligence. Agentic is essentially creating an agent or a bot. You may have heard that as well, where you are engineering it to take AI, which is artificial intelligence until it's not, right? And teach it to do a specific task. And you're seeing this today. You're seeing bots pop up in your day-to-day life, personal or professional, where you ask the bot to summarize a long piece, you know, an article. You ask the bot to write you an introductory email. You ask the bots to do maybe a social content. So right now, it's really good at just reading, summarizing, and writing, and continues to be. You know, that's how it, I should say, not right now, but at the start of November 2022, when ChatGPT popped up in our lives. And I think this is absolute stroke of luck that happened to us at BrightHive, because the public became aware, right? So it was doing these tasks for you. And then now for us, when we say we're a different kind of agentic AI, because not all AI is equal, we've taken the promise of AI and have been following it for a while. We've been agentic before agentic became cool, and said, okay, what if you take these agents and focus them to learn complex data engineering and data analysis tasks? So now you are telling it, hey, governance. You're a governance agent. Can you help me identify when there's PII in the data set? PII stands for personal identifiable information, right? And governance is not new, right? Nobody wants your social security and birth date to ever be exposed together. And so as an example, I created an agent, or we created an agent at BrightHive, that's the governance agent, and it has learned to do that specific task. Identify for Christian in his data set all of the rows where there are all of the fields that are PII. And by the way, I've taught it what PII is, right? So it knows. And when you step back and think about that for a minute, especially with the size of data, right? These Excel spreadsheets have hundreds of thousands of rows. Quickly, an autonomous agent, think of it as your teammate, right? Sitting in your BrightHive platform, surfaces that for you and tells you, here it is, this column, and this column. Qualify to be PII, right? And these are the things that you have to apply a governance policy around. And then the platform or the agent itself help you apply that. So that's an example of how you would create a logic or create kind of a context, teach it to a bot and create an agent out of it, give it that specific task and let it do that task autonomously, consistently all day long. Now, what happens when this, you know, and this is the case, is that very much like human beings, they learn. The bots and the agents start to learn because you've given them one singular thing. So if a carpenter does one thing all the time, guess what? They get really good and they become a very skilled carpenter. And, you know, people want that carpenter to create all kinds of pieces for their home. It's the same logic when it comes to agents. When you create a small task and not be generalist, and get and monitor its performance, look at the success of it, tell it when it did it right and when it didn't do it correctly. The learning curve is incredible. The performance it outpaces human capacity, because we rightfully have human error in our processing, as we should. I don't think we should engineer that out of the human brain. And so where we get excited when we show this to our clients and our prospects and our customers that sign up is we drive a conversation around, now imagine that we're automating 80% of grunt work in managing data, cleansing data, making data usable. and allowing teams and people to actually use their high human intelligence capabilities on all kinds of other things that we have never had the time for because we're busy trying to, you know, figure out our data sets. So when you think about agents, you think about them as helpful, autonomous, you know, extension of your team that learn the workflows, and every company under the sun, regardless of size, has a workflow. And the reason for this is because if you're using software, you've created a process around anything, whether it's POs, AR, AP, whatever it is, right? The enterprise has a ton of workflow. We excel at making it complicated sometimes. So the agents learn that, right? You teach it what your kind of dictionary, if you will, and it then uses that to do the exact tasks that you would be doing otherwise, and delivering to you those productivity gains on a day-to-day basis.
Totally makes sense. It's brilliant. And what year did you start the company?
We started initially in 2018. The very first 2 years of our life, we were really kind of focusing in on the data space as a whole. And we weren't necessarily solving it with an agentic point of view. In 20, we saw that it absolutely is possible. In the first 24 months, we were a technology-enabled services company solving a full end-to-end data collaboration and data sharing set of services with our platform to a bunch of clients. And we're able to see this problem repeat itself enough that then we stepped back and said, okay, the on-ramp to working with your data is a huge opportunity and also a huge pain point. Can we solve for that, right? And be able to make anybody become a data analyst? Because once you actually solve for the on-ramp of how to get your data on, how to cleanse it, how to protect it, how to make it usable, and create the data pipelines, then the agentic piece, you can ask any question, and that's what you're engaging with today with AI. It's a conversational UI, and then it runs the analysis for you and so forth. So in 20, our evolution became, let's solve the hardest part of data, which is getting it usable and working with it and really giving everybody a full data team in a box. And by the way, we can do that because AI is very powerful. So in 20, we started our agentic, plan.
And we're, for everyone's benefit, we're reporting this mid Q1 2025. I'd say in the past few quarters, AI agents have started to show up more and more places.
Right.
Have you? My sense is that we're at the tip of the iceberg. Have you seen an acceleration of interest in the last couple of quarters? Has this been going on for well over a year?
Yeah, and a couple of quarters would be at the lowest end for sure. I believe what happens, and not everyone needs to be and will you know necessarily be very fluent in the technical piece of it. But you know, there's research that gets published all the time, and when you read it, or at least get the Cliff's Notes, we are all learning that mathematically. The possibilities of AI are endless, right? Mathematically, the reasoning is getting stronger. And so when you hear the media talk about that, and you may not pick up the 300-page proof to it from a Google lab or OpenAI, but you're hearing all about the advancements. As a consumer of it, or as the enterprise, because we're a B2B platform, we show that in our product, right? We are able to show you that because reasoning is possible and mathematically infinite, it's going to get better and better. That's why my product and these features that I've coded and this platform that I've built as BrightHive can deliver the promise that you're seeking. So as we show our buyers, which are decision makers and senior level C-suite teams at any organization under the sun, they're starting to realize, look at that, for half of one headcount salary, I'm bringing a full data team that does all of the necessary tasks for data management and data governance and data analysis. And what we benefit from that is we're improving and increasing the data maturity of the organization as a whole. We're improving our data fluency in the organization as a whole because the platform is deployed enterprise-wide. Users are unlimited, load your data in your cloud, company, whatever, XYZ, and you're giving your workforce the agentic tools that really accelerate that insight and drive the whole culture. So where we get excited about why, the reason to buy, why BrightHive, this is a future of work agenda where we move from looking at a dashboard and not being sure if the data on it is stale, not being sure if something that you're looking at is really the most, you know, recent data set, wanting to create a different data view, but having to wait on somebody in a central data team in your company to actually work within your warehouse because you're in the strategy team and you don't know those, you know, that kind of toolkit to use. So we're just breaking down those walls where the capabilities that people have don't limit them from the insight that they need to, you know, have access to do their day-to-day work.
Fantastic. I'm curious. So was there one use case in particular that was the inspiration to pursue this path? And since then, mm-hmm. are there any other use cases that, you know, you've either popped up or you said, oh my gosh, you know, we really have some market interest here?
Yeah. You know, in the energy space, it's where we started kind of acutely seeing, because with energy and the energy industry, it is not a new industry. It's a it will always be there. Everybody needs electricity and energy of all types. And the industry as a whole is on the kind of traditional side, right, with its investments in general in the data infrastructure and in infrastructure as a whole and architecture. And so you have a lot of utilities and energy companies that have a lot of data but are held back by the infrastructure kind of modern day architecture that you would need to really unlock data tools, data analysis tools. And so when we talk to we're talking about, you know, top energy utilities in the country, over $1 billion in EBITDA. They struggle with this because they tell us we are making the investments now in this architecture, but we've been around, you know, for over a century, and it is not something that you are going to solve in a quarter. We can't wait 3 to 5 years to be able to unlock the insights on the consumers that we serve, which is people, right? As we understand demand, the pressures we get from different commissions, it's a regulated industry, right, on pricing. And so how do we work with our data while we're making investments in infrastructure and architecture in a meaningful way to create more fluidity, right, and be able to get us more into the modern day age of cloud and other things. And so you kind of see that there's a business need, you have the data assets, and it just depends on the maturity of your architecture in some cases. Unless you're a brand new, net new renewables, green energy company, you're really going to be held back by some architectural decisions. You just need to become more modern day. And so that's when we realized that creating a flywheel and a velocity around data and insights shouldn't be hindered, because by the time you get all your data in one warehouse, for example, on a Snowflake or Azure, that's an 18-month deployment. Should you become, you know, should you wait 18 months and kind of be uninformed or very limited in your knowledge? No. So that's kind of where we started to see that even traditional industry is ripe for us to create that agentic flywheel on the data assets, because we deploy in your cloud, everything is protected in your cloud, you load into our platform and you let the agents run, and you're able to see the insights while you can still drive all the other CIO's agenda items as it relates to infrastructure.
Without revealing any trade secrets, what's been then your path to foster adoption, and what's the trajectory been looking like to attain product market fit?
So product market fit is there, and we've built it around an initial PMF for sure. Where the path of accelerating adoption, you know, you got to educate the market to capture it 100%, which means this is a sales cycle that requires you to invest a lot more in telling the story, right? Creating the intrigue. And not just telling people, but just showing them too. So being able to create, you know, what we call demo domination culture, right? Be able to quickly show a demo, get them for a pilot, completely let it be accessible and free, and create believers because they're in the platform working. It's not a slide deck. It's not, you know, things that I just tell you and expect you to buy. This is an important buy. We are seeing that, you know, in 23, there was enough intrigue about AI, but still it's unknown and vague. Some dollars were created as part of the CIO's office, as kind of the innovation agenda or the AI accelerator pilot. And there was some experimentation, but that was not real sticky ARR. It is just to see if this thing is real, right? The AI era that we're going in. But when you were going into kind of 24, less than 10% actually moved into production. All this AI experimentation that was funded by, you know, innovation dollars that were kind of limited, but didn't really create believers. From 24 till the end of 24, we're starting to see very different case. 40 to 50% now is going in production. And the reason for that to accelerate so quickly is that you're just letting them be able to touch it, feel it, and live with it for a while, right? So the traditional B2B SaaS GTM ways are rewritten in a manner where you need to be completely open to a conversation where you're going to tell story, where you're going to have to dedicate time to, it's a change management agenda partly as well, because you're trying to get over the fear that this is not going to be disruptive. And that's why it was initially limited in a pilot. That's what was happening in 2023. In 24, you're seeing the market be very interested enough, but now it's the question of which AI, right? Which tools and where in the enterprise? And that's where our GTM is centered around being able to have everybody get in a sandbox, have a pilot, support it with our own team, being able to train and answer questions and follow up. So it's a more high touch. And you know, our ACV is such it allows us to do that, and then the relationship that's there becomes really sticky because you make heroes out of everyone that you spend the time educating to capture.
I'm curious: what's the onboarding like? Is it minor lift, major lift?
In a week, it's the speed of adoption, and like I said, just letting them see that versus talking about it. It just shortens the resistance and shortens kind of this 4 to 6 months. Technically, the deployment itself is in a week. We're live, right? Assuming contracts are signed and all of that. And then the enterprise is on, right? You invite people to a platform. It's very similar to any modern day SaaS. But the power of the features and the tools themselves, that's what creates the acceleration in the adoption. Because it's, you know, it's conversational.
I'd love to know your philosophy on budget allocation between product development and sales and marketing. And is that somewhat fixed, or is it totally dependent on where you are in your growth stage?
You're asking the question from a startup's point of view on how we split the budget, not from the customer side.
From your side, yes.
Right, yes. Yes. So when we think about product development and GTM. GTM today has become very SaaS in its way and very even transformed very heavily with AI. We don't do ads because this is a high value buy and it is very new. And so the budgets that we have for GTM are focused on specific platforms that get us to understand everything about a prospect that's on our website that we maybe have met at an event that has attended a webinar. So enriching the lead and enriching the pipeline from every angle, right? And so why does that matter? Because you're able to just have a much more informative conversation than spraying and praying where you're spending, you know, millions of dollars on ads to be able to get 100 leads that are the actual qualified buyers. And so we invest our GTM dollars in platforms that get us to understand the profile of our ICP. We know it, we've defined it, seeing more of that ICP in the data. And then we zero in not on the millions, but on the 10,000, right, at the right buying level and being showing targeted personalized content, very personalized actually. And now again, AI makes that possible from a GTM perspective. And then you're able to bring them into the sales funnel, you know, into gate two or three by the time you're deploying a trial. So that today also doesn't require a big sales team, right? The people that I work with on our sales team, the rest of the team, they're sales engineers. They're fluent in the business language, but also understand the how to use sales tools and essentially deploy them like any other SaaS to understand the key metrics and translate the metrics into actual movements. And that's made the budget really not necessarily shrink, but have a lot more efficiency. We're putting much more of our operating budget into product development, because this is a space where you have to invest in it enough to keep relevant and create your own moat. So it is not, we don't have, a huge Salesforce team. We don't believe you need that. You need a good, great story. You need a tight process, and you need to have the right data partners from a sales perspective to enrich that pipeline that you need.
And I'm curious, because it sounds like you're having a tremendous amount of success. How often are you iterating the approach? Is it weekly, monthly, quarterly?
As we're out there learning, sometimes you could be a brand new company in 6 months in your approach, right? Like, just like we said, the acceleration by which the community and the business community and just the world's taking notice of agentic in the last 8 months, this time last year, nobody knew what agentic AI is. Nobody dubbed 25 to be the agent year, none of that. So in 6 months, by middle of the year, it changed. So yes, within 6 months, you're still getting a pulse on the market. How educated is it? What's the velocity of the market? The urgency to buy, the budgets that are starting to come up. In one quarter or two for us, we come back to prospects, or they come back to us with a greater sense of urgency, because almost everyone in the C-suite is being asked at the board level, or if you're privately held, just generally for your competitive edge, you're trying to figure out your AI adoption strategy. And so someone who you may have talked to through, three quarters didn't have the urgency, but all of a sudden they're coming knocking on your door saying, okay, we really want to move faster now. We kind of see the impact of this technology era because we've never experienced anything like it. And people are just trying to figure out to what extent is it actually, going to be a game changer. So someone who you would have spoken with 3 quarters ago comes and starts knocking, and you kind of see their own growth in understanding what this is and the value add, and they move much faster. And that's what we do, right? We consistently every 6 months take a good look at our sales process and say, does it need to be as many gates, right? Does it make sense to take them down this life cycle, right? Where do we create momentum and incentivize, to kind of move faster? So as in anything in building a startup, you have to be relevant and PMF it all the way.
Love it. That's great. Yeah. If we take a step back, I'd love to know a little bit about your background and how it led up to BrightHive.
Right. So I am born and raised in Cairo, Egypt. I came to the United States in the mid-90s at the ripe age of 20 to come and do my graduate work, as all, immigrants, good immigrants do, get more education. And this is a time when the birth of the @ sign, as I say, people don't remember that. And then I'll say, the www dot, if you were not alive then, or don't know what we're talking about, that's kind of funny. And actually, if you really don't know the Y2K, some of us will remember that. So I consider myself quite lucky as someone who immigrated to the United States. It'll be 30 years for me this year, 2025, to just, grow and learn and believe in, I kind of believed that was the right path for me leaving Egypt and relocating here. I was not intending to stay in the United States, but I did. I landed at IBM Global Services. At the time, Big Blue was the place to be as a technologist. I've always been a technologist all my life. I got my first master's in computer science back when, very different languages were being taught. C++ and Java and Linux and mainframe. So I was in the hardware business. And so I mentioned I consider myself very lucky because for 30 years, I've been in every chapter of technology evolution. I started my career on Caldwell Road in the Bay Area in San Francisco, San Jose, and learned so much. I spent the first 16 years of my life in big corporate, worked at places, worked at GE Healthcare, worked at IBM, as I mentioned, HSBC, was an expat in the Middle East, even for the University of Chicago, leading educational reform for the state of Qatar, huge investments back then. But then again, the problem was there was no data. And then, you continue to ride my career. It just went with the iPad and the smartphone and then the app economy. And again, data being produced more and more in leaps and bounds. And in 2010, I knew as a very, at this point, not an individual contributor anymore, very much an executive and a leader. And spent half of that, those 16 years, equal parts being in-house and consulting, being a consultant and for firms. And so you kind of started to realize, there was something I'm missing, and I wanted to, my own growth, continue on and figure out something else about these companies that I'm working in. And it was really the business side of all of this. And that that meant just, agendas and strategic initiatives and beyond just deploying technology or innovating technology. And that's when I went back to school and did my executive MBA at University of Chicago, Chicago Booth, the best school, business school on the planet. Focused my MBA time in venture capital finance and entrepreneurship. And then as I graduated in 12, became an entrepreneur. It's 13 years now, and never looked back. And so Bright Hive is my fourth endeavor, two exits and one failure. The failure taught me a lot more than the exits. And it's amazing how that is in itself very powerful to just reflect on today. And Bright Hive, like I said, all of my career endeavors as an entrepreneur are technology. So this isn't the new part, but I think my passion for sure around Bright Hive's mission and solving the accessibility and being able to use data as the first thing you look at every day before you decide what to do, right? If we can rewrite all the job descriptions and write them in a way that you're going to be doing this task or this job from a very data-informed point of view, the reason that really became evident to me that that should be my next startup is looking at, we're figuring out EVs and we're exploring Mars and we're doing all these great things, but at the end of the day, we're not as data fluent as we should be as a society. And to me, that's just backward. We should be able to solve this age-old problem of cracking insights faster, having more conviction in what you're recommending and what you're going to be doing, and educating people along the way that this is what the data shows. Therefore, this is the right next action to take.
You answered my next question for me. Thank you. Congrats on the two successes. But before we go there, why don't we start with the company that didn't work out? Key lessons learned?
The first is you need strategics at the table, just as much as you have generalists at the table. And when it comes to investors, there's a balance and a dance between that, and that's important, especially for crowded and saturated categories. Secondly, perfect is the enemy of good, and people that you work alongside of need to understand that. You can put something out at 60%. And learn more from the market around what you should do next and be able to take that, right, to continue to refine the experience. And people, my co-founder at the time, when I reflect back at kind of, what could have been different, it's the natural tendency for human beings to overestimate the risk and completely underestimate the opportunity. And when you, as a founder, go into this, not being mindful that you're going to naturally do that, right? That silently is creating a lot, it's creating a context for you where you make some of these mistakes because human beings are just risk averse, right? And my co-founder was, very, very intelligent, lawyer, Northwestern alum. Like this isn't someone who isn't, on the books, capable or anything like that. So that it doesn't have anything to do with credentialing, but it's more around what does it mean to be a founder, right? And what does it mean to take that risk from day one? The hardest thing I always tell people is to start. But once you start, you're like 70% of the journey is done. The rest of the time as you're doing this, you're doing it with conviction, but you need to keep yourself in check because if you're consistently overinflating the risk, you're missing very important signals, right? When they are your path to the greatest opportunity. And that's, those are the two things I would say. Perfect's the enemy of good. And be very careful and mindful of the fact that at the end of the day, we are much more risk averse and we should keep that in check and go further, question more, have more conviction.
I 100% agree. I think that's great insight. Recently, I don't know, he may have said this a while ago, but I recently read Peter Thiel was commenting on Elon and said something to the fact of, when he started SpaceX and Tesla at the same time, everyone thought he was crazy. Fast forward today and you look at the success that he's had, Peter said something effective. Maybe everyone else needs to reassess how we think about risk to your, right. to your point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I'm a risk taker person by nature, regardless of being a founder or not. And like even in my investments, you know, my husband and I are very different. I'm very, I'll eat it all day long. I love it. And my husband is no way, you know, 10,000. I mean, he's a physician. So there's, they control that heavily, being an ICU physician. So it's just, we're different. When you do start a company with a co-founder though, this has to be something that you align on. So not only being mindful of it, but then who you're going to start a company with, you need to be aligned that this is something that we have to have. There are a few things that you should have common beliefs in, because I do think complementary, being different is a good thing. But when it comes to this topic, it matters, because it affects the speed by which the evolution and innovation, that just building a startup, right? We're going to be hindering each other if we're completely fighting the idea that I need to manage risk and somebody else sitting over saying, nope, take more of it, you know? So I would agree with that about Elon Musk.
It's interesting. So that echoes the sentiment that's come up on the podcast of people characterizing co-founders as a marriage, and that successful marriages complement one another, but also can see to eye to eye on the really important and difficult decisions that need to be made.
Yeah, and trusting the other, right? You may not naturally do something the way that comes natural to me, but trust that Suzanne in her judgment, right? And her ability to just actually make the right decision.
Until there's reason not to, 100%.
Right.
Agreed. Two successful exits. Any key takeaways there that you can share with us?
Absolutely. The team. I know people say it a lot. I don't think we say it enough. And what is it about the team, right? And remembering that before you earn customers, you have to make believers of your team members, right? The people that you brought on. This is critical. And the reason for that is everybody needs to look at this with a level of conviction and passion and commitment to the mission internally well before you're going to earn a customer. It makes a difference in every task that gets executed, because you're bringing people on to do specific things. And so very much like a great orchestra that is harmoniously playing together, every single one of the instruments has to be in tune and knows its role and delivers, you know, on the night of the show. The team is that, right? And that the difference is people have to be brought along, right? You have to think about the culture, the psychology, your communication style, your transparency, you know, honoring where people are and bringing them along, allowing for diversity of thought. It creates the alpha. There's so much that has to be right with team, so that everything else around the company and the brand and earning the customers actually happens, and then earning the investors if that's what you're going to do. Not everybody has to fundraise, but it starts with the connective tissue around the team, and beyond just assembling a great team, but how they work together, the empowerment, the why, right? Everybody has to have a why. Just earlier, I got asked, you know, we're going to be heading to HumanX that we're sponsoring in Vegas on March 10th, and we're creating our collateral for our booth. And I got, you know, one of the younger team members is asking, what size should the, you know, note card be? And my question is, what do you think? You know, so involving them into this stuff. And I always say my leadership style is not prescriptive. That is one thing that I can't, you know, it's probably the topic for another podcast. And the scenarios of where you bringing back things to the team and telling them and showing them that you believe in them to solve the hard parts. It is night and day difference. You're giving them autonomy, right? And you're delegating.
Actions speak louder than words. I'm curious, where do you fall in the higher slow, fire fast camp?
Higher slow, fire fast. Well, fire fast for sure. That is what I will say. My superpower as Suzanne is that I read character quick. Mm-hmm. And that is something that as you become more, you know, older, wiser, you realize a day makes a difference, because you can't bring that day back. And days and time for me are far more important and scarce and valuable than money. Because if I take too long and be, you know, dragging my feet and uncertain about people, then I don't have that humming engine that I just, you know, spent all these minutes describing. And so I don't hire fast, but I don't hire slow either. I'm consistently looking. I am consistently meeting people. I have in my mind the kind of the persona of the cult. I always say there's cultural fit and technical fit. And I tell founders, understand the difference between the two. It's not just technical fit and it's not just cultural fit. I've definitely hired people that have technically a great fit, culturally not great. Mm-hmm. They were out within 6 weeks. Right. Mm-hmm. And that even was a little too long, but we had to finish an implementation. So I separate between cultural fit and technical fit. I have a persona in my mind that is fitting for a starting point. And what you do after you come in will show me that we got the balance of those right or we didn't. And then, you know, you have to part ways.
Love it. And I on a side note, I agree. I think your approach is spot on. Suzanne, and on that note, genuinely appreciative of your time. Thank you. Before we wrap up, if you had an opportunity to go back and talk to your younger self, what would you share?
I talk to her often, actually, my 8-year-old self. Yeah. I have a picture of my 8-year-old self at my birthday, in fact. My mother had me dressed in an obnoxious outfit that I didn't rebel either. So in a way, I hope we all are talking to our younger selves. I think what we are not doing enough of is keeping that younger Suzanne or whoever alive, right? Because it is so refreshing when you look at children. And I choose to speak to an 8-year-old versus a 21-year-old. And I know your question typically is young youth entering the workforce. To get there, I like to point to an even younger self, right? And that's the one that I always, you know, answer the question from. Fearless, the world's my oyster, completely optimistic. Why not me, right? That's why not? I am capable and I am able and I will get there. And it's for me to actually prove. So when I realized that the kind of the fearlessness that we had when we were children we all had it, right? You may not be the most extrovert person, but when you are a child, you haven't been tinted by adulthood. I mean, adulthood is a trap, 1000%. I tell my kids every day. So I'm always very conscious to make sure that I bring the 47 this April Suzanne to the 8-year-old Suzanne, right? And remind her of how she behaved and how she navigated her life as a young, very young child with that, absolutely the world's my oyster and I can go do anything. That's what I would tell every age, right? And every Suzanne, that don't forget that because that's true. What gets in the way is what I said earlier. We then learn to be risk averse and we then somehow learn to overinflate the risk, underestimate the opportunity. And then we change at whatever age that is for every person. It's unique.
Did you just happen to avoid the risk averse part or was there something in particular that took place where you saw for what it is?
In particular for me, it's my immigrant hunger. And when I came to the United States, I was not the same Suzanne that you're interviewing today, right? I had to conform to exist. And I didn't like that at a later point in time. But of course, sure. I had to conform to exist. I mean, the brands I'm working at, right? IBM, GE Healthcare. I mean, hello, Jack Welch, right? Bottom 10% gets fired every year. And so you never wanted to be the person that wasn't going to conform to exist. And you really, as I was going to Booth, I was 32 when I started to realize I get one shot at life. And if every, you know, if on average, when you stand to go swing at the bat, and it takes 10 years because entrepreneurship is about 7 to 10 years, how many times am I going to be swinging? And for any of us, they're very few.
I love it. Very logical and rational. Yeah. That's great.
So that's what got me to just look at life differently.
You're right. We probably could devote an entire podcast to unpacking that further. But it's brilliant. And I'm really happy for you because it sounds like you're having a tremendous amount of success, not only with Bright Hype, but in your career. So high five.
Thank you.
Suzanne, before we wrap up, if there's anyone who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Absolutely. So brighthype.ai, our website. You know, I hope everyone visits there and reads about our agents and kind of, you know, sees for themselves the vision that we see for the world and for the future of work. And sign up for a demo, sign up for our newsletter. Also find me on LinkedIn. My DM's always open. I love to meet people. I get all kinds of messages. Yes, some that are trying to sell, some that are trying to recruit you, but a lot of people that are just actually asking a point of view, right? And so I love to exchange what I believe and hear where people are on this journey of exploration on what the future could be. We hear the future is different. It's going to be different, but what could that be? And find us at HumanX if you're going to be going there as well. So it seems to be, the event for leaders to understand the potential of AI and stop by our booth, E3.
Fantastic. Suzanne L. Morsi, co-founder and CEO of BrightHive.ai. Suzanne, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much for listening.
My pleasure. Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinTrap Management. It's been another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day and weekend.
Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.